This is a Doxcast, not an Argon Soxcast, or a Bendis and Loxcast. Now I'm hungry. This is a Doxcast. It's a nerdy Toxcast. Discuss a Moxcast with Rich Early and friends.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another political episode of the Doxcast. I'm your co-host, Josh Trumbo, and with me, as always, is the despotish Richard John Early. Rich, how are you doing today?
Wow. Yeah. I mean, wow.
I asked your employees what I should use to nice. Describe you, and that's what they came up with.
Jeez, and I dropped kick the employee night and everything. So, welcome to the Doxcast, everybody. And we're here with Professor Tom Ambrosio today. How are you, Tom?
Very well, very well.
You know, Josh, you say this is another political episode. That's funny because it's actually going to be our second political episode we've ever done. And it harkens back to the first one, which also starred Tom Ambrosio. So we only talk politics when we bring Tom on board.
I think is a good idea given some of the other guests we've had and hosts.
Yeah.
Some of a one-trick pony, I guess, but yeah. Politics is my life.
Well, you're a fascinating person in what you do in the real world and what your hobby is and how those sort of have some overlap, and that's what we're sort of going to talk about. But, you know, tell us, just tell the internet who you are a little bit here, and I'm sure they already know. But.
Sure. Tom Ambrosio, I'm a professor of political science and in particular international relations at North Dakota State University. I've been there since 2000, which is hard to believe. It's been that long I've been at NDSU. My areas, I actually study a lot about Russia and the former Soviet Union and authoritarianism. So I kind of have my hand in a lot of different pots. And so other than that, that's kind of the professional life. That's what pays the bills. But I'm an avid board gamer. I try to board game as much as possible. And there's a lot of overlap between the kind of games I like and my interest in politics.
Yeah, and that's the driving force that I think is most interesting. But you get to travel a lot
in
your career as well.
I've been very fortunate. I've done a lot of – I've actually been invited to overseas for conferences. I've gone to conferences on my own. And like this year I have five conferences – two of which are overseas. There's a lot of travel, but it's great to see different places, and I love going to Europe. I'm going to Berlin this summer, so that's going to be nice. I've never been to Berlin before, so that'll be exciting. And I've also led study abroads for students, so short-term study abroads, like 10 days or so. Last one I did was last summer, and we went to London, which is a fascinating city. It's great. And one of the best things about London is almost all the museums are free.
Oh, wow.
So once you get there, you just kind of go in and out wherever you want. So it's really fun.
Well, usually what I do now is with guests is I like to kick off with some simple questions and about your basically sort of about your childhood. Get on the couch, Tom. No. So you love board games. Did you always love board games? Like, when did you fall in love with board games? What was like the first board game where you were like, yeah, this is it?
Well, it's hard. My mother and I, we would play a lot of board games. You know, obviously when we were really young, Chutes and Ladders, things like that. But I think it really kind of kicked off when I was in college. During high school, I did a lot of role-playing games. So that was kind of my focus instead of board games. And then in college, I did a lot of like Axis and Allies, Fortress America, those types of games. So those that were big at the time. And then it kind of went fallow for a long time. And then I actually got into Warhammer 40K, 40,000, as well as Warhammer Fantasy. So I became a miniature gamer for a while. And then I met some people, and from there on, it's been board games kind of ever since. But I still dabble occasionally into miniature games, though I just don't have the time. I need to hit the lottery to have more time to play more games.
That's funny. I find that a lot. Comics is my thing, and I'm in that boat where I don't have time to, you know. So, when did global politics or Russia? I mean, how did that happen? When did you fall in love there?
Right. My family, even though they were not involved in politics, we always talked politics. at the dinner table, always talked about kind of events in the world. A lot of it was kind of international focused. And I wasn't really surprised that I decided to go into political science as an undergrad. I was always interested in this. And I grew up during the Cold War. I graduated high school in 1989. So that gives you a sense of, you know, the true end of the kind of the end of the Cold War was when I graduated high school. So the Cold War and the events going on in the world were such a big part of my life that there was really no option for me other than to go into politics or political science. And then from there, I went to graduate school, and Russia's kind of where it's at. Even during the 1990s, I studied Russia. I studied ethnic conflicts, which were in Bosnia and Rwanda and lots of different places in Eastern Europe. So, and from there, got the job. So I've been doing it ever since.
Is there a moment when board games and political science come together for you in some way?
Yeah, I really – actually, one of the games I got when I was in college was called Politica, which is an awful game. looking back on it – but at the time, it was kind of an interesting game. Of course, games have changed so much over the decades. But this was a game in which it takes place after the Soviet Union's collapsed, and you're different factions fighting over Russia. So you have the nationalists, you have the communists, you have the KGB, you have the industrialists, and as we know, the KGB wound up winning that game. Both, you know, in the game, which actually they were a strong faction anyway, and they wound up winning in real life with Vladimir Putin becoming president. So in that sense, I really like those types of games. I like historical games. I like games about politics. I like area control games, and part of like I'm building something. So those types of games lend themselves to politics and to political issues.
And Josh, I don't mean to dominate all the questions. If you
no, that's just fine. But yeah, political games and things that go in that sort of stratosphere are a bit more outside of my what I tend to play personally. But I know some, you know, like Twilight Struggle.
I was going to say Twilight Struggle is
probably one of it's still regarded one of the best board games, and it's just a two-player. One's U.S. and one is Russia, correct?
Absolutely.
Yeah, so it's definitely present, you know, in games like Churchill.
If you can only buy one game, definitely, if you're interested in politics, buy Twilight Struggle. It's a great two-player, exactly, and you refight the Cold War. And it's a card-based game as well as area control because you're trying to control different parts of the world. And that's one of the games that kind of got me into board gaming. Kind of my second life of board gaming was actually Twilight Struggle. And there's lots of different games like that by GMT, which is the company that has a lot of games that are sometimes two players. There's one I recently got on where you refight the Algerian Civil War. One person plays the French, one person plays the Algerians, and you kind of refight that. So you have this sense of history, and also it's learning. I enjoy that. So you kind of learn about what's going on, but through the cards and things like that.
Yeah, learning's dumb.
Spoken like a true comic book fan, yeah. Right?
So I'm gonna go back to your first appearance in the DoxCast.
Sure.
One of the things that you talked about when it came to the landscape of nations around the world was. You were saying that the 20th century had been very much about, especially from the U.S., trying to control, you know, trying to keep order and trying to control things. And you said that we are going to enter an era of decentralization and a little more chaos. Is that – that was, what, probably 4 years ago?
That was.
On a DoxCast. How do you feel about that today? Is that still what you think? You know, can you just talk about the – and we don't want to get, like, super this side or that side. I just want to sort of talk about the world, you know.
Yeah. I mean, we think about it, the end of the Cold War, okay, the Soviet Union collapses. We have this multi-generational struggle. The United States emerges as the most powerful country the world has ever seen, with truly global reach, truly global interests, maximum power on every single indices of power. That could not last. One of the great truths of the universe is entropy. Mm-hmm. Everything ends. And it's kind of a natural progression. And during the 90s, we were super powerful. And then in 2000, things started falling apart. And now we're seeing the consequences of that, in which America is simply overstretched. We can't afford it all. And we're seeing other powers rise. I like to think about the one date that I was telling my students for the rest of my career. And it's a date that most people don't know, but is the most important date, I would say, in the post-Cold War, which is September 30th, 2015. That was the day that Russia launched its first airstrikes in Syria. Now, why is that important? It's the first time a country other than the United States or its allies used force outside of its immediate neighborhood. It basically a great power other than the United States acting like a great power. So these transition that we're seeing now is I would argue it's natural. It had to happen, and one could argue it's kind of surprising it didn't happen before. But we're seeing the rise of Russia. Though Russia is relatively weak, the real game, a great game, is Asia. That's really where it is. The rise of China, second largest economy in the world, largest population, and they are reaching. They are reaching hard, and in fact, just opened up a base in Djibouti in Africa, which is a clear sign that we're now going to have to deal with other countries, not as superior to inferior, but as semi-equals. So I would say that's kind of what the world is like now. We're in a world that's where America is still the most powerful country, but countries nipping at our heels, and more than that, regionally, we're getting weaker and weaker in different places.
I'm going to throw a couple of random, very armchair novice things at you, but I did really have the sense during the middle teens here, the 20 teens, that there was this time that the U.S. absolutely was the dominant force in the Middle East. Like, that it was our playground, right? It was us versus them, but I mean, we were the ones with the influence and all that, and that's absolutely shifted, right? I mean, or Russia is trying to shift it,
and the Syrian civil war has accelerated that. But actually, I just wrote a paper, an article with three undergraduate students. And we examined President Obama's State of the Union addresses, and also his kind of general foreign policy views. And he wanted to shift away from the Middle East. He wanted to get us out of the Middle East and towards Asia, where the action's happening. And it's somewhat purposeful, not getting involved in these Middle East crises, not having as much of a footprint. It was kind of a purposeful from President Obama, and then Trump has continued that and tried to kind of focus away from the Middle East. So, yeah, the Middle East was our playground. Then Russia shows up, and Russia used the Syrian civil war as a way to put its foot in. And now Russia's there. We have Iran, and America's like, this is a problem place. And it's a place that we're not going to have any friends. We're our many friends. It's not a place that we need to expend our resources, in my view. So,
well, two interesting things happened, I think, at the beginning of the Trump administration that had a lot of people scared. And I'm really curious what you would think of these two things. But we launch a missile attack into Syria,
right?
And we stand off with North Korea. Now, you're the expert, not me. It seemed to me in both cases that it was a new administration letting certain players know that you couldn't push us around, or trying to get a chip on a certain table or something like that. Like, is there any validity to that, or am I way off base?
No, I don't think you're way off. I think that Syria crossed a red line with the use of chemical weapons, which yielded this response by the Trump administration. They had done the same thing under Obama, and Obama had actually used the word red line. And then when Syria did it, they didn't respond. So there was some sense of, look, we are going to set clear boundaries for this war. And one of the boundaries is use of chemical weapons, though more recently Syrians have used chemical weapons and we don't really care so much. North Korea is – I don't think it was on Trump's radar. I bet you if you go back and look at his speeches during the campaign, he barely mentioned North Korea. But interestingly enough, when right after the election, President Trump went to the White House to meet with President Obama, or at that time, President-elect Trump, and supposedly the biggest thing they talked about was North Korea. whereas where Obama was saying, you're going to have a problem with North Korea. This will be your biggest foreign policy challenge. And Obama didn't really have a plan for North Korea. And I think that our current standoff and the heightening rhetoric is due to the sense of this is a real threat, or at least perceived as a real threat to us.
Do you think there was a lot of hysteria about being on the verge of war with Korea, North Korea, nuclear war, things like that? I guess, and I don't know why this is, but you know, growing up through the Cold War and all that sort of stuff, it didn't strike me the same way. I thought there was this was still he's postured a lot in the past, and he's always kind of done that after sanctions or things like that. And that it just seemed like the same rhetoric, maybe to a higher level. But I guess I never really thought, oh boy, we could be at war tomorrow. You know, that never crossed my mind the way it did for a lot of people.
No, I had said that. I would be completely shocked, and I can't imagine that we would be at war with North Korea. Though if it happened, it probably wouldn't surprise me all that much. It's one of those kind of situations. Like, I could see it happening, but the calculations on both sides, neither side can win in a war. President Clinton had thought about actually striking at North Korea because of its nuclear program, and the calculus was that we would have unacceptable costs, not to us, but to South Korea and potentially Japan. So they scrapped that plan. And every administration since has faced the exact same dynamic, which is the capital of South Korea is right next to the border, and it would be destroyed. And we're talking about hundreds of thousands of casualties at a minimum within 24 hours. And so the U.S. does not want to go to war. North Korea doesn't want to go to war because they know they'll lose a war. They know they will lose, and they want to survive. They don't, you know, they don't want to be overthrown. But the real danger is that with the heightened rhetoric is that one side may believe the other one's actually – the rhetoric is serious, and they may decide to launch what they think is a preemptive strike in which we – you know, we think North Korea may launch at us or at South Korea, and then we launch first, and it's kind of an accidental war. I think that's the real danger more than anything.
And last question, too much on politics, and then I'm gonna turn you guys loose on board games. But any of that down there, you know, Trump comes in, he calls Taiwan during the transition, right? And there was a hubbub about that. He stands off against North Korea, and he talks all this trade war stuff with China, right? Is there a pattern there? Is it all about China, or was this very specifically about North Korea?
I think China is on the radar for Trump, as it was for Obama. And I think that in many ways Trump wants to make that transition, but you have so much other chaos kind of going on that there really isn't a coherent policy there, unfortunately. But I think that in his heart of hearts, that's where the action is. The center of the world is moving where it had moved from Europe to the United States, and now it's moving towards the Pacific between the U.S. and China. That's where the center of power in the world is going. And we keep getting dragged back into the Middle East, and we really need to focus on Asia if we're going to keep kind of playing that great power role. Though some would argue we shouldn't even do that. But that's kind of where the action is.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just it's fascinating, and it's been a fascinating time, you know, on many levels when it comes to politics. So
it's been a time of transition. We'll put it that way.
Yes.
Are you a Vladimir Putin fan?
I actually have
a T-shirt.
I actually have a sweatshirt that says Vladimir has basically Putin. It's a bunch of pictures of Putin and a heart. And it's like Putin, more than a comrade. So he's very good at what he does. The Russians have always played a weak hand well. They always punch above their weight class, and no one does it better than Putin. And that's admirable in many ways, though I wouldn't want to live under him.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, okay. So board games. Yeah.
Well, no, I was going to say it's it's very interesting listening to you talk about this and some of the strategic positioning and all those things and how it feels almost like you're talking about a board game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And if we think about the Cold War, the image that one can think about is a chess game.
Yeah.
In which we have our kings and queens, which are our main pieces, which are us, and then we have our pawns. And we were fighting this chess match for the kind of a long-term game against the other side. So, yeah, it is very much a board game in some ways where the world is the board.
Right. And, yeah, it's all about having your virtual presence in some places. Like, hey, we're not going to attack you, but we could.
We could. That's why we have all those aircraft carriers.
Yep, exactly. So to bring it around more fully into the board games, we talked about a few different board games at the start. Would you say there's any that really replicate that, the kind of feel of, that not just warring with each other, but also the trade-off, the give and go, the kind of, some of the things we're seeing from some of the powers in the world right now?
Sure. Actually, I'm going to make a big plug for Twilight Imperium 4th Edition.
That's what I was thinking of, yes.
I'm going to make a big plug for that. Come down to Paradox and pick up your copy. Because the 4th Edition, if you played 3rd Edition, 4th Edition is so much better. It is far more political. You can do a lot more trading of influence and... if you've ever played the game, the promissory notes that you can make are far better and far more meaningful, and they're not as kind of cookie cutter. There is the game itself is much more streamlined. It used to be very heavy in terms of the technology tree and all that. It's much smoother now. So it is a real improvement.
And Twilight Imperium, especially the 3rd edition, was well known for being an 8-hour game in some circles.
Yes.
Obviously, the more you play it and the better you get at it, the more you can whittle that down. But it was just notorious for, you're going to play Twilight Imperium? All right, we'll see you next week.
Yeah, we've been playing it pretty regularly since it came out. And our games are still 7 hours long. And these are experienced players. But it is a game. It is an experience, and I think you should think of it as an experience. And you got to see this universe unfold, and also the storyline itself is really interesting. Mm-hmm. It's a power vacuum, and nature as well as power abhors a vacuum, and just moves in, and that's kind of exactly what the game is like.
Well, and it's interesting that you can have, a game. And to be completely honest, I've never actually played any version of Twilight Imperium.
Oh,
but I
need to get you on board.
I know. I need to set aside a week where I can play. but that's something that fascinates me is when you have a board game that, in terms of moving towards the end, like the mechanics and the pieces of it and stuff, there's a lot going on, but it's not that people aren't doing anything. Because you get those board games where it just takes super long for someone to take their turn.
Right,
and so you're just sitting there and waiting for your turn to come back around. But this, if my impression is correct, there's a lot of stuff happening. You're pretty into it like the whole time.
You should be engaged. People could take a while, but the map can change so quickly that you really need to kind of be thinking 2-3 mm-hmm. steps ahead. So that's a great game. Another game that I like is actually Venezia.
Hmm.
I like games that that are theme heavy, but have within them some kind of internal dynamic or system that actually helps to get the theme across.
Right.
So Venezia is a game in which you are playing different houses in Venice, and you actually have the rise and fall of the Venetian Empire.
Hmm.
I love Italy. I've been there like 4 times, and it's.
I have a bottle opener from one of your visits there.
Oh yes, that's right. And the great thing is, it's easier initially, but then as the game goes along, there's an internal system that means the empire will fall, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Huh.
You have to manage that collapse.
Interesting.
So those types of games that have something like that, even if the game is not a great game. I think Venezia is a really good game, but games like that I just love.
When you can marry your mechanic and your flavor together, mm-hmm. is when you've really got a home run. And I've played games where there's a system that the game has, the numbers and the way the game plays or whatever, and then it's just got art or theme slapped on it from a license or whatever, and you mm-hmm. can tell. But yeah, when that marriage happens is when you really get something unique.
Another game I would push, very similar but completely different, is actually New Bedford. Hmm. It's a whaling game. And you think, okay, it's a whaling game. You are developing the city of New Bedford, and so there's a little bit of worker placement on different locations, mm-hmm. as well as you're sending out ships to go whaling. But the beauty of the whaling game is that there's a bag that's the ocean, and there are whales in there, of course, and then there are blank sea tiles because you don't go catching, you go fishing.
Right.
As you catch whales, the whales come out of the bag, but the blanks always go back in. So as the game goes along, you are overfishing because mm-hmm. at a certain point, you're only going to pull blanks. And it has that feel, and that's kind of where the game will eventually end. You have this feel of what happened to these sailing cities. That they just, you go out, you're sending boats out, and they're not catching anything anymore. So games like that, I just love those, yeah.
Now, I got to ask. Okay, so New Bedford and Venezia, right? Like, who the hell designs these? Like, what I'm saying is, like, I love, do I have an idea for a game first, or do I love The Fall of Venice first? You know, like, what, and who do I think I'm going to sell this to? You know, well, you.
Me,
but,
obviously.
Right, but I mean, and I guess I just think from a business or a marketing, I'm like, who's buying this, you know, besides Tom? So I just find these fascinating. I'm not criticizing them. I just find it utterly fascinating.
Mm-hmm. But I think if you can marry those two, the mm-hmm. theme and the system, mm-hmm. I think you're going to have a home run on your hands. I think you really are as a game. I think it's going to be one that people are going to look to. I think that's key.
Well, and it's very interesting to look at, you know, the history of board gaming, which in terms of modern board gaming and the hobby board gaming, it's not even that old, really. I mean, you can trace some things pretty far back, but it doesn't seem like even that long ago when there was a very clear division, and there was the Euro game, which right. was very mechanic heavy, and the theme was, that's why we have so many games about farming. You know, it's just like, whatever, this kind of makes sense, just throw it in there. It's all about the resource management and, you know, the mechanics of the game. And then you had the lovingly termed Ameritrash game, which was all about theme, and it was usually very fiddly. Arkham Horror is one of the
a lot of dice rolling.
Yeah, luck, very luck driven. A lot of little rules to accommodate every single kind of scenario. Again, Arkham Horror is the one I'm most familiar with that comes up in those conversations. And so it's like, well, you have a flying monster, and then you have an elusive monster, and then you have a fast monster, and it's like, it all makes sense. Because of the different types of things that there are, and the rules all capture that, but it's just a ton of rules that you have to keep track of, and all these little tokens and things. And more it seems like we're seeing a good that marriage of theme and mechanics. And I think that's really cool to see that kind of, you know, you still get some that are very one side or the other. But a game that I recently got into, which is Gaia Project.
Right.
Which is...
what a great game.
Oh, it's so good.
Which is Twilight Imperia... Or, I mean, I'm sorry, Terra Mystica in space.
Yes. And it's like, you could probably retheme that, and it wouldn't be too difficult. But the way they set it up makes sense. And so when I'm playing it, I don't necessarily feel like I'm an alien race trying to take over the galaxy. But when I go up the tech track... it makes sense that, you know, the decisions I'm making and the benefits I'm getting from it seem to make sense in that world. So it's, you know, you have some games like that even where it's not a 100%, you know, like, oh, this feels thematically accurate, but you're still getting something out of it than just, all right, now I'm trying to figure out this part of the puzzle and I'm, you know.
Right. A Terra Mystica, which was the kind of the precursor to that, is one of those, it's just a game that I would play like right now.
Yeah.
Without even thinking about it. It's just, it is like one of the best games that I think that's out there. And that's one I would recommend for anyone who's interested in board games. And it's a nice, it's a nice Euro type mm-hmm. game, but it doesn't feel like a Euro so much.
It's not so dry. Like you, the terminology and everything that you're doing has enough style to it, you know, a bit of substance to it that you're like, okay, yeah, I'm going to terraform this so that my faction can live here. And, you know, it's, yeah.
Another great game I think that marries the two, though it's really more Euro than Amara trash, but is Terraforming Mars.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't played that, I definitely recommend playing that game. You play a corporation and you are transforming Mars into a place where humans are going to live. And you actually you're completing projects. So you have these cards that you're trying to get resources to complete projects. And it feels like you're actually seeing Mars develop. You're planting trees. You're developing cities. You're mining. And every game feels different because of the choices people make that will – in some cases, Mars is pretty desolate. Mm-hmm. As other cases, Mars has lots of stuff on it. And it's just – it's kind of an interesting – that's a really good game. I would definitely recommend that one.
We should put a title on this episode, Games That Cost $80 or More, I think is the
Yeah, well, and it's funny because a lot of these games we're talking about right now are some of the heavier games, but they're good examples. But if you want to go the other end of the spectrum, you can talk like Renegade. We talk about Renegade games quite a bit frequently, and had a whole game night. And some of those games have been great because the rules make sense from a thematic standpoint. Like Clank is a wonderful example.
Right. Clank is fun. Yeah, it's a fun game.
Yeah. And it's just
if people haven't played that one, you're basically a dungeon. You're going into a dungeon trying to get treasure and get out before the dragon eats you.
Yep. Trying to best your fellow thieves. And the whole mechanic around making noise or clank is so central to the game. And it just fits in so well that all the pieces just kind of come together and it makes a great experience.
And there's also a Clank in Space, which I have not played yet.
Mm-hmm.
But that one fixes, I think, some of the not really flaws, but some of the limitations of the first one.
Yeah, no, it did. It complicates the board more, right. And it makes the resolution of the game more clean. It's a good game. I always have a problem selling games that are so similar because people, you know, I spent $60 on Clank. So Clank in Space might be a little better, a little different, but I own Clank, you know, so that's always kind of a weird window to be in for me. So.
Well, I got into the pandemics as well.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
People have pandemics.
Oh, yeah, that's passed. We've gone over the edge of like, yeah, okay, like, thanks, guys. Like, we'll sell Pandemic Legacies every year. Great. But, yeah, I don't need Pandemic Cthulhu and Zombie and, you know, blah, blah,
Rising
blah.
Rising Tide so, just came out.
Yeah. I know. I'm kind of actually interested in that one, but Iberia is actually quite good. It's pandemic, but it's not a full reskin.
Right.
The Cthulhu isn't a full reskin either, but actually Iberia feels a little different. It's kind of a different way in which you're developing things. So I really like Iberia.
Okay, so given the way you think about this stuff and the games you like and what you do for a career, would you ever design your own? Do you have like a dream project?
I do.
All right.
But I have not been able to get around to it. And it is my dream, and I want to somehow find time to do it.
Ian, you don't have to tell us. I'm just curious.
Well, I will tell you. Actually, it's fine.
Copyright Tom Ambrosio.
This will be recorded for posterity. So
yeah.
Exactly. One of the most fascinating periods in the Soviet Union is right after Stalin died. And there was a fight for power who would succeed Stalin. And I would love to play a game in which you play the principal players.
Hmm.
At fighting over who's going to lead the Soviet Union. You had Beria, you had Molotov, you had Khrushchev. You had these different factions that were all trying to do it. And there's actually a movie about it, which I haven't seen yet. It hasn't come to Fargo, about the death of Stalin. And I'm really looking forward to that one. It's by the person who's a showrunner for Veep.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. And I'm really looking forward to this. It's kind of a dark comedy. The Russians hate it because it makes Stalin look bad, which is kind of weird. They kind of love Stalin now in many ways. But that's what I would love to play or love to design, something like that. Something similar to that, though different, is that game Churchill that you mentioned.
Yeah.
If you haven't played Churchill, it's kind of a heavy game, but it's you're playing the three great powers, the Allies – the Soviets, the British, and the United States, and you're trying to kind of shape the post-war world as well as fighting the war itself.
Right. So you have to work together to make sure you still win the war, but you have to try to pull the power in your favor enough that, you know, the other players don't basically just cut you off and or, you know, try to come together to take you down so that they can grab the power. And yeah,
it's this three-way struggle. Though actually, my friend Josh and I broke the game. We figured out you don't need to win the war.
Oh, really?
In order to win. It actually has more points to be found elsewhere. So I think it – and I actually wrote the designer of it and was like, hey, so would this happen? He's like, we didn't think about that. and I got the sense from him, he was like, you know, you and your friends are awful for not desiring to win the war. And a very simple fix could fix the game. Very easy home rule, which would be very simple, very clean. But it was kind of funny that it's like, oh, we broke the game. And
that's great.
Yeah. And in this, the last game we played of it, there was two of us who were like, well, forget about the war. We're going to go for points. And then one person was caring about the war, and they just wound up being left in the dirt. So
what do you – okay. Well, my key at wrap-up questions are going to be about roller derby. And
oh, absolutely.
There we go. Yes.
But do you have any – do we want to talk any more board games before we do that?
I would say that actually, if you're interested in history and politics and you want something that maybe, again, a little heavier, kind of more in depth, I don't play the Hex game, so I'm not like a war gamer in that sense, but a lot of stuff from GMT, their coin series, a counterinsurgency series, are excellent games. I mentioned the one game about Algeria where you refight the Algerian war, and it feels like you actually, it's a game that's great. And it's a great experience, but you're not necessarily having fun because it's so tense. But it's a fascinating game. You actually feel like if you're the insurgency, you have to play that game differently than if you play the French. There was another similar game called Labyrinth in which one person plays Al-Qaeda, one person plays the United States, and you're fighting this kind of global conflict. So there's lots of games like that which are really meaty, but they're so good, so good. But then again, you have light games too. I just got in a Rising Sun, which is an Eric Lang game, and it's by the designer of Blood Rage, and I'm looking forward to that. The Kickstarter was the box was 15 pounds, so it's a lot of game there.
Competing with Gloomhaven, maybe heavier than Gloomhaven?
Altogether, because it's two separate boxes, a base box, and you have the expansion, then there's another expansion, then a bunch of little expansions, like, yeah. There's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
So I have to throw this in there real quick because this seems relevant. But you've heard about the game, the campaign for North Africa.
Yes. Right?
That notoriously takes about 1,500 hours to complete. Is that one ever on your list of ones to acquire, if not play?
No, probably not. but there actually was a game that's kind of similar. It was similar to Twilight Struggle, in which you play the interwar period in terms of play. You know, so one person plays the Soviets, one person plays essentially the Allies, another person plays the Axis, and it's a political card-driven game. They never really updated it, which is kind of a shame. I almost wish GMT would take it over somehow. It was an Australia game group. But then you play that game, and then they had a follow-on game, which is kind of like the North Africa where you refight World War II, and it's hex-based game. But the decisions you make during the interwar period will affect what happens later.
Huh.
So that would kind of a grail game experience. Right. That would kind of be it, in which you'd figure out the interwar period, and then those decisions would lead to the war itself. So if you have Romania on your side, then you would have Romanian troops available to you and things like that. So that would be the kind of the grail experience.
Interesting.
A friend of mine wanted to make a game. I used to joke about a board game with that subject matter, and he wanted to call it Divide and Congo. I loved it. I would
at least pick it up and look at it based on that title.
Exactly. So, okay. So, one last thing about you. You've got a really solid game group, right? You play all the time.
Every Wednesday here at Paradox.
Yep.
And we were doing it on Sundays for a while, but then one of our group got married and
Ty, we're looking at you.
And just fell off the face of the earth. But there's also casual board gamers or the casual board game meetup. And that's starting. That's doing well. So I actually went to that on Sunday. So trying to get games in as much as possible. Definitely Wednesdays. Every Wednesday we're here at Paradox. And last night we just played Zulkin. And which is a worker placement in which it's kind of the Mayan calendar, and it has a real interesting system in which you place your workers, but also time is a resource. So the more time you spend, you have your workers kind of out of your control, the better your rewards are. And the board actually shifts. There's actually a wheel that actually turns to different parts of the board.
Nice.
It's a fun kind of visual
game.
That's
a really good one. Yeah.
It's a fun game.
So. Talk to me about roller derby.
Roller derby, absolutely. I have been involved in roller
derby.
Do
you play?
I do not.
Oh, okay.
I was a coach for a little while, actually. I've been an announcer now for 7.5 years. My wife was one of the founders of the Fargo-Moorhead Derby Girls. So I've been involved in it since the very beginning in one capacity or another. And we have a bout coming up on St. Patrick's Day. And if those of you out there who have... Remember our last St. Patrick's Day bout? It was a hoot because the weather was great, everyone was lit, and we just had a great time. And we're having a St. Patrick's Day bout this year, and I was able to get the group or get the Derby Girls to make Extra Life our featured charity. So every bout we have a charity, and Extra Life is our charity this year. I tried to get them to donate to my Extra Life fund, but they're going to give rights to Extra Life in general. So it's like, just that way I can be better than the rest of my group by having more donations than anyone else. But it's still, St. Patrick's Day, easy to remember. It's Saturday. It's going to be at the Civic downtown, and hopefully it'll be warm. We're going to have the parade right beforehand, and then Derby. It's going to be a great bout. I think it's Bismarck. The Bizman bombshells are coming out. So it's going to be a fun time and get some great roller derby action. And that's just like board games taking off, roller derby has exploded since 2000. And we now no longer have a nationals. We now have internationals.
Oh, wow.
In which it's for the first time ever, a non-U.S. team is the champion of the world from Australia. And we just finished up with the World Cup, which you have the best teams of throughout the world. And the U.S. won that one. But it was U.S., then Australia, then Canada, kind of the three big ones.
So, oh, wow.
Yeah, it was really fun.
Now, I remember, I know we're running out of time here, but there was at a convention not too terribly long ago, you were demoing a roller derby-based board game.
Yes. That was an unfortunate game.
Oh, yeah.
Yes. It was much slower than it should have been. It took forever to get around the track. I think if I was to create to marry kind of theme and mechanics, it would actually be more of a card game where you'd be constantly countering each other.
Right.
In some ways, almost like Magic or some of those other types of card games in which you're doing something that someone else is responding, and you're trying to score points. And I'm blocking, I'm creating a wall, I'm breaking through the wall, things of that nature. I think that would actually be a better game than the miniature game. In theory, it was great, but in practice, it really was not.
Well, and was it ever really produced? I don't remember seeing anything about it after that.
It did come out. Okay. I was supposed to get myself a free copy of it, and I had written a very long description of the problems of the game, and they never got back to me. So they were not very happy about that, I think.
Well,
thoughtful comments. I mean,
I
wound up, it's like, this game is slow. I love roller derby, and I'm getting bored. So, that's not how it should be. It should be something like really exciting. So, some kind of a card-based game I think would be great, where things are constantly happening. Racing games in general can be slow.
What's the best, like, sports translation game?
I don't remember the name of it. It recently came out. I know you have it here in the store.
Oh, is it the bicycle one that...
I've heard that's really good, the bicycle one.
I can't remember what that's called right now. Really helpful information for those listening at home.
But there's another more recent racing game, which is more card-based. And that does feel like it's you're kind of racing.
Yeah.
So those types of games, I think... you know, racing games can be, you know, it's supposed to be a race, and if it's taking time, then it doesn't feel that
right. Because, yeah, Formula D, I always had fun playing, but it takes its time because you have to count a lot. It's a lot of, okay, I can move this far. Where do I want to go? I need to get over here, you know. Yep. And so it's just like tracing your steps, so I've had fun playing that, but, yeah, it's definitely – it doesn't feel like you're racing. You're just kind of calculating.
Right. Some things don't translate well into board games.
Yeah.
And I think races – again, I heard the game that we can't remember the name of, the bicycle game is supposed to be really good. I've heard that really does feel like a race.
Yeah.
So. Heck, Camelot is better.
Flam Le Rouge, something
yes,
like
I
that?
Think that's it. Flam Le Rouge.
Yeah.
Even Camel Up, I think, was better than the Roller.
Oh, Derby. Camel Up was a load of fun. But that was more about the bidding than the racing itself.
Yes.
But it, yeah.
But it's also fun to have camels jumping on top of each other.
Well, yeah.
What's wrong with that?
A stack of camels. I've said it for years.
Well, on that note, yeah, we're at the end of our time, and a mm-hmm. couple of housekeeping things. So we record live on Facebook and on Twitch, and then we release episodes on iTunes every Monday morning of the DocsCast. We've done over 200 episodes. Our goal right now is to pack all our episodes with guests. So we're really thankful for Tom coming and joining us. And
absolutely.
I think we could probably talk for two more hours about games, but
oh my goodness, yeah.
You know, Tom, how do we find you? And does it do you any good to pitch your classes? You know, do you need to?
I think I'm doing well on that.
All right.
You know, if you're interested in coming out playing some games Wednesdays here at Paradox, mm-hmm. We start about 5:30, and we actually have a Fez that we pass around. Whoever's the Fez holder gets to choose the game. It's a good way that we're not sitting around debating which game we're going to play. And I actually have the Fez this week coming up, and I have chosen Rising Sun. I'm going to be bringing it in the whole 15 pounds of it.
Yes.
We'll reserve two tables for you. What about your radio career?
Oh, actually, I'm on the radio every Wednesday morning at 9:30 on Mike McFeely's show on WDAY, where I talk about international politics every week. I actually was doing it whenever there was crises, and at a certain point, Mike was like, look, there's always a crisis. Come on every week, because it was just getting that, you know, rather just have a set time. It's easier that way. So Wednesdays at 9:30.
There you go.
All right.
Well, thank you.
Well, thanks, everybody, for tuning in, and we hope you enjoyed this. I don't know. I can't think. I'm not as good at Josh as the puns. Sorry.
Oh, now you're looking at me.
The podcast of politics.
There you go.
Oh, nice.
And potpourri board games.
Yes.
Well, actually, I'm going to throw this. So Lance Meister and I had an idea, right? So what we want to do is we're both, I mean, he's called the Undead Vikings. So we're both huge Minnesota Vikings fans. Well, over the years, what would happen is he would come into the shop, and we have very diametrically opposed views of the Vikings. And so we would argue, and we'd argue for hours sometimes, right? And we're like, this should be a podcast. And so finally, I was like, you know what would be really cool? A Minnesota Vikings nerd podcast. Like, we talk like Vikings football and our nerds. And the passion is the connection, obviously, right? So maybe this is something you could do is politics and board games is a podcast.
And talk about kind of how some board games do really well in terms of marrying. Mm-hmm.
I wonder if there wouldn't be a real niche there, actually.
Maybe.
Like, that would work. And I'm going to be trying to fill up a YouTube channel with podcasts, so maybe I'll hit you up and see if we can get this thing
Ooh,
going.
Sounds good.
So, all right. All right. Thanks, everybody, for that on-air production meeting.
Yes.
We'll talk to you on the next episode of the DocsCast.
This was the DocsCast. Hope you think it rocks, cast. Oh, look at the clock's cast. Until next time, geek.